Lecture 20, World Crises.
It is June 1976, and the passenger jet has just taken off from Athens Airport. This is the flight headed for Paris, with over 250 people aboard. As the plane lifts higher and higher into the air, a young woman in her 20s who had been sitting in first class gets up, turns around, holds up both her hands, and starts shouting loudly in German-accented English, "Sit down!" At first, people simply stare. They don't really understand what's going on, but then they notice that in either hand, the young woman is holding a grenade at the ready. Obeying her commands, all of the first-class passengers stumble backwards towards the back of the plane, towards coach class, where three male hijackers are watching the rest of the passengers. At this point, a French oil executive sobs out loud that this is the second time that he has been hijacked, and he doesn't know if he can make it this time. What will happen next? We'll see later in this lecture. Apart from the Cold War, or intersecting with the Cold War in complicated ways, were other global developments of the 1970s. These included the growth of terrorism, regional conflicts flaring up, and growing security concerns with world implications. Newer intelligence organizations like Israel's Mossad and the agencies of Pakistan, China, and other countries became increasingly prominent. It should also be added that we know less about these institutions than some of the major Western ones, in part because of their more recent activity, which is harder to get a firm fix on. Communist China had been declared in 1949, after Chairman Mao's victory in the Chinese Civil War between Chinese nationalists and communists that had been put on hold from 1937 to 1945 in order to fight World War II against the Japanese. Afterward, it became very difficult for outside powers to get a clear understanding of what was happening in that vast country of China. Inserting human intelligence turned out to be a tremendously difficult task. U-2 spy plane overflights of China took place in 1964 to track China's acquisition of its own nuclear weapons in this global arms race. In the early years, Chinese intelligence offices cooperated extensively with the Soviets, learning from the NKVD and then from the KGB, who functioned really as their teachers, instructing them from their larger store of prior experience. But then Chinese and Russian relations broke down over doctrinal questions and the issue of who was best suited to lead the communist movement worldwide. And then these intelligence ties between the intelligence services broke down as well. When Chairman Mao launched the violent Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976, one of the rallying cries of that movement was to purge China, to fight against foreign infiltration. And this was really, in a sense, a page from the playbook of Stalin and his great purges and great terror. Ordinary Chinese, who before the revolution had perhaps worked for American businesses located in China, were now denounced as spies, as were fellow traveling communists from abroad who had come to live in China, admiring the creation of a new society that they saw as under construction with the leadership of Mao. Even as China increasingly closed itself off from what was seen as corrupting outside influence, Chinese human intelligence was capable of producing some astonishing coups. In 1964, a French Foreign Service accountant named Bernard Boursicot was newly posted to the embassy in Beijing. In Beijing, he met Xu Peipu at a party. The 20-year-old Frenchman was intrigued by Xu, who spoke excellent French, was socially tremendously polished, and taught Chinese to the diplomatic community in Beijing. Very soon, he fell in love. Xu was a Chinese opera singer who, and this is complicated, posed as a man who posed as a woman who in fact was a man. There are echoes here of the famous Chevalier d'Eon from our earlier lectures. The story was very convoluted. Shu dressed like a man, but told Boursicot that in fact he or she was originally a woman who had been brought up as a man and now played roles of both sexes on stage. Boursicot and Shu began an affair, though to try to imagine how Shu kept up the imposture through their physical entanglements is really mind-boggling. At any rate, enchanted by Shu, Boursicot passed documents to the Chinese. Shu told the Frenchman that he had fathered a son who had been sent to live far away with Shu's relatives in the outer reaches of China. And the reason that was adduced for this was that an Amerasian child in these turmoil-filled days of the Cultural Revolution would have a much easier time of it away from the centers of political power. Boursicot continued spying for the Chinese at other postings, and in 1982, Shu came to Paris to join him, but the French intelligence service arrested them both. The French authorities rejected Shu's claims upon arrest that he was a woman, and after a medical examination, they sent him to a men's prison. Boursicot and Shu were both convicted in 1986 and sent to jail. The French press had a field day. It called Shu the Chinese Mata Hari. And then, when the press announced that the Chinese Mata Hari, in fact, was a man, Boursicot, who heard the news in jail, tried to slit his wrists in despair. Eventually, both were pardoned after serving only a brief part of their terms. And in fact, a play, Monsieur Butterfly, was written about the mysterious affair. This is further evidence for the point of view that espionage is often stranger in fact than in the creations of literary fiction. While the United States did not have diplomatic relations with Communist China before 1972, at this point, the British colony of Hong Kong was a crucial window into Chinese society, one of the few such windows. Hong Kong thus became a station for American intelligence gathering. Refugees who left China and came to Hong Kong were extensively interviewed. They were sat down and asked questions about the economic realities of the day, the political line, essentially all sorts of questions, trying to get a fix on what was going on inside the mysterious mainland. Especially during the confused convulsions of the Cultural Revolution. Similarly, economic figures were scrutinized for exports or imports to try to get some sort of handle on what was going on inside. This changed when in 1972, President Nixon went to China and established relations with that power in a bid to balance off against the Soviet Union. Now, in advance of Nixon's much-publicized visit in 1972, secret talks had actually been taking place unofficially for years before, very formal and very awkward talks. The meetings took place in a palace in Poland that had been provided by the Polish authorities, where American and Chinese diplomats could meet for very scripted formal exchanges, but nonetheless ones that moved them towards diplomatic recognition. Polish intelligence also bugged the talks and passed along the transcripts to their Soviet patrons. Oddly enough, the Americans knew about the bugging and appeared not to mind, as this was a channel to the Soviets as well, to, as it were, inform them that there were other configurations for the Cold War than the one currently on offer and that America might avail itself of those. It's fascinating how this situation resembles an earlier one we saw in the lecture on the American Revolutionary War, when Benjamin Franklin's diplomatic negotiations with the French were actually being spied upon by a spy for the British. And Franklin was perhaps not averse to the British learning of his secret diplomacy, as it put greater pressure on the British to come to some understanding. In this case, the Americans also appreciated the bugging because it saved them time and effort. They simply spliced in a device of their own to the bug to save the trouble of making their own recording. So in some sense, you could say they were bugging a bug. Another newer intelligence agency that emerged in this period also was that of the newly independent state of Pakistan, one of the countries that emerged from what had been British India. In August 1947, Pakistan became independent. Pakistan's ISI, or Inter-Services Intelligence, was founded in 1948 by a British Army officer. The agency has played an important role in that country's history, and it's been deeply involved in its domestic politics as well, but its critics have charged it with following its own policies very autonomously. Now, a fascinating point to note here is that even if the ISI was founded by a British officer and drew thus on British experience and those long-term traditions of intelligence in the British Empire, which we saw had long precedence, the ISI would still have its own priorities and interests. The great game it would play would be one of its own choosing rather than inherited from the British Empire. So it really shouldn't have been a surprise. It stands to reason. As a key example of the ISI's concern is the disputed territory of Kashmir, which is claimed by both Pakistan and India. It's reported in the media that the ISI has tried to influence and shape and move public opinion and public debate in Western countries on this question in order to bolster Pakistan's claim to Kashmir. Critics of the ISI have seen its role as ambivalent in the task of combating terrorism. On the one hand, Pakistan was considered a vital American ally in that conflict. But on the other hand, some critics charge that the ISI has communication channels with some fundamentalist militant groups in the region. Covert operations played a larger role also in the unsettled history of Iran. This territory, earlier called Persia, already had an ancient history of spying, as we saw way back at the start of this course in Lecture 2, when, as you'll recall, special royal supervisors traveled in disguise through the realm as the so-called eyes and ears of the king. After the Second World War, Iran was ruled by the Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1953, the charismatic prime minister of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, who had come to power in 1951, declared his intention of nationalizing the Iranian oil industry and aligned himself with a pro-communist political party in the process. The CIA and the British launched Operation Ajax to depose Mossadegh. That was the American name for the operation. The British code name was Operation Boot. You recall, good tradecraft isn't really supposed to suggest what's going to happen in an operation. This one rather gave away the game because the point was to give Mossadegh the boot. The Americans and the British fomented unrest in the streets and sponsored riots, which led to a coup, and Mossadegh was first arrested and then sent into exile. Now, while the toppling of Mossadegh was considered by the CIA as one of the classic cases of its triumphs at the time, it was intensely resented by many Iranians and others in the Middle East. And you can probably see where I'm going with this as well. It stored up a lot of bitterness for the longer term that would have an impact in decades to come. From that point, the Shah's regime, enjoying the support of the United States because it was seen as an island of stability, in President Carter's words, in the Middle East, and as a bulwark in the Cold War, was undergirded by a notorious secret police working for the Shah, the SAVAK, which was set up in the later 1950s. The name is a contraction of the title in Farsi for Security and Intelligence Organization. The SAVAK clamped down on internal dissent with great harshness, which was tremendously resented, and also kept Iranian students studying abroad, overseas, under surveillance. In part, this kind of repression tended to radicalize those who were its targets. From the 1950s, the CIA also maintained a presence of its own in Iran in order to be listening to Soviet radio transmissions close to the Soviet border. And the CIA cooperated with the SAVAK. This turned out to have a crucial implication. Because the CIA was getting its information about Iran from the SAVAK, the CIA was caught unprepared for what happened in January 1979. Islamic fundamentalist radicals, led by Ayatollah Khomeini, came to power in a revolution. In November 1979, supporters of that new regime took hostages in the American embassy in Tehran. There's a breach of diplomatic immunity. They held the hostages for 444 days. An American covert operation to rescue those hostages failed in April 1980. Operation Eagle Claw was scuttled when problems with the helicopters happened, and the hostages would only be released in early 1981. There's a fascinating postscript here that bears on espionage and questions of technology versus human determination. After the American embassy had been taken, the captors found reams of shredded documents that had been shredded by the CIA officials in advance of the embassy being seized. And the Iranian radicals then spent days and days laboriously piecing all of those shredded documents together by hand to uncover their secrets, with dreadful results for those who were mentioned in the CIA documents. This is really a compelling testimony to the limits of technology, in this case of a shredding machine, versus the dogged determination and commitment of human actors fired, in this case, by ideological motivation. At just this time, a further crisis was rocking global politics, a new episode in the Cold War, but with far larger implications for the very long term. This was the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. All at once, the competition in Central Asia of the great game of Rudyard Kipling's novel Kim seemed to come alive again. The strategic dominance of this crucial region once again seemed to be at stake. In 1978, a pro-Soviet regime had taken power in Afghanistan. When it seemed about to fall due to its internal unpopularity, the Soviet Union invaded, intervened in December of 1979. And the war that followed would last 10 years. The Soviet Union paid a large price for this move internationally. Loans and credits from the West ceased. They were broken off. Soviet debt exploded. Détente efforts that had been going with the United States were now shelved and put aside. A chill descended on international politics. And lots of international censure was directed against the Soviet Union as a result. Moreover, facts on the ground were also quite negative. Soviet forces found themselves locked into major cities and controlled major supply routes, but otherwise were unable to crush the Afghan fighters called the Mujahideen out in the countryside and away from the major cities. The Mujahideen saw themselves as holy warriors holding off the foreign invaders. They were provided arms shipments by the United States. Additional foreigners were recruited to come fight a religious war by impresarios like Osama bin Laden. As the war dragged on, Soviet soldiers grew demoralized, prey to drug addiction, and brutalized. Little wonder that this came to be called the Soviets' Vietnam. Texas Democratic Congressman Charles Wilson was a special patron of CIA operations focused on Afghanistan. Through congressional appropriations, which he was very ably able to steer, Wilson provided huge sums for the project and leveraged his unruly and, it has to be said, larger-than-life-size persona to lobby for this cause. This is very convincingly portrayed in the tremendous film Charlie Wilson's War. The United States supplied special Stinger handheld missiles to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, enabling them to bring down Soviet helicopter gunships. Now, there's also in this story a Tennessee angle, which I simply can't resist relating because the University of Tennessee is where I teach. To carry in those supplies that were being provided for the Mujahideen, the CIA arranged for durable pack animals to be used. About 2,000 mules from Tennessee were brought to do the work. And I sometimes ask myself, perhaps some of the descendants of those original mules are still there in Afghanistan. It's a poignant thought. What must have been the reaction of those Tennessee mules when they first arrived, coming from the lush landscapes of Tennessee, the greenest state in the land of the free, to find themselves in the rocky, dry, formidable heights of Afghanistan? Sensing defeat, the Soviets finally withdrew by February of 1989. Afterwards, Afghanistan was not helped to reconstruct in sufficient measure, and radical groups like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda exploited the chaos, which continues there to this day. Next, we need to consider the legendary intelligence service of the recently founded State of Israel. Israel had declared its independence in May 1948 and immediately found itself at war with surrounding Arab states. Israeli intelligence networks actually had their roots in the period before independence, when the area was held as a British mandate. Paramilitary groups had been formed then, with differing aims. Some attacked the British with guerrilla tactics and terrorist bombings. Others, by contrast, worked alongside British authorities. During the Second World War, special commando units had actually been organized for the event that the Nazis might reach Palestine. Israel had several different agencies, but of them, the Mossad acquired legendary proportions globally and is still viewed in those terms today. Mossad is short for the full title of Institute for Intelligence and Special Operations, founded April 1, 1951, in many ways on the model of the CIA. Mossad's motto on its seal is biblical. Where there is no counsel, the people perish, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. In spite of significant problems in its early stages, Mossad scored important successes. These included gaining a copy of Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956, in which the Soviet leader initiated a break with Stalinism inside the Soviet Union. Mossad also worked to track down Nazis. Its most spectacular coup was the capture of Adolf Eichmann in Argentina. Eichmann, you'll recall, had been a key subordinate of Reinhard Heydrich, the chief of the Central Security Agency of the Third Reich. Eichmann had been a master of logistics in organizing mass genocide, one of the planners of the Final Solution. After the war, Eichmann had escaped, using one of the routes organized for war criminals of the Nazi elite, and made his way to Argentina. Together with Shin Bet, the Israeli Internal Security Agency, Mossad suddenly descended on Eichmann in May 1960, kidnapping him as he returned home from work and flew him back to Jerusalem to stand trial in a public and memorable way. Mossad also delivered key military intelligence in the 1967 Six-Day War, which proved less successful in the lead-up to the Yom Kippur War of 1973. Mossad also aided Israel's determination to build an atom bomb of its own as a powerful deterrent. The plan had been developed in 1965 and was called the Samson Option, as a way of warding off enemies. A problem was getting access to the needed supplies of uranium. Mossad agents cultivated a relationship with a West German company, one of whose partners was a former Luftwaffe pilot, who felt remorse about his service to a regime like the Nazis. As this relationship grew, the German businessman agreed to help obtain needed uranium ore, allegedly for research in nuclear power. The German company then informed the International Atomic Energy Agency, which needed to sign off on such transactions, that ore was needed for a new soap manufacturing procedure. A front company was established, which bought an old German merchant ship, which received the 200 tons of uranium in Antwerp, Belgium, in November of 1968. At Hamburg, the crew of the ship was surprised to be told that the ship had been sold by its owners, a new crew had been found, and the old crew was now paid off very generously, but were out of a job and off the ship. The new crew boarded silently without talking to the old crew, and the ship sailed off. Much later, the ship appeared again in Palermo, Sicily, but without its load. When the ship put in, the captain and the crew walked off the ship and were never seen again. Enough material for 10 atomic bombs had disappeared. And according to later testimony, this was the basis for Israel's nuclear deterrent, which is not publicly acknowledged, but is an open secret. A terrorist act at the 1972 Munich Olympics saw 11 Israeli athletes killed by a Palestinian group calling itself Black September. What followed was an Israeli operation to seek retribution, which was dubbed by the media Wrath of God. That was not Mossad's title for the operation. The agents forming the so-called Avner Group were allegedly told to resign from Mossad to give deniability. The group was allotted large funds and provided with a list of 11 targets for assassination, including Yasser Arafat's cousin in Rome and other figures in Paris and Beirut. A separate team was sent after the alleged mastermind of the Munich massacre, Ali Hassan Salameh, but in this case, the careful tracing went awry. The team believed they had found their man working as a waiter in Lillehammer in Norway in 1973. But after they'd killed him, it turns out the victim was an innocent man, a Moroccan guest worker. The Norwegian police arrested the assassination team and linked them to Mossad. Eventually, Salameh was tracked down and killed by car bomb in Beirut in 1979. In 1976, Mossad also went into action for a dramatic hostage rescue. In June 1976, Palestinian terrorists had hijacked an Air France passenger plane flying from Tel Aviv to Paris when it stopped in Athens. And this is the story with which we opened this lecture. The terrorists demanded the release of prisoners in Israel and two German terrorists. As they awaited a response, the terrorists flew the plane to Entebbe, Uganda. There they announced they would blow up the plane if their demands were not met. They also separated the Jewish passengers from the others and released their non-Jewish hostages. In government meetings, the Mossad chief argued for an operation to save and free those being held. This was Operation Thunderbolt. Israeli special forces raided the airport, and in the course of 5 minutes, 97 passengers and crew were liberated, with all but four hostages saved. Among those killed in the raid was an Israeli officer in the strike force, the older brother of the future Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. The Mossad action at Entebbe helped to build up that formidable aura of Mossad's effectiveness. One Israeli government minister proudly announced at the time, "We do the impossible." Given the long-standing relationship between the United States and Israel, revelations of a spy scandal in 1985 came as a blow to those ties. In 1985, Jonathan J. Pollard, a U.S. Navy intelligence analyst at the Naval Intelligence Support Center in Maryland, was spotted by a colleague leaving their building with envelopes that were marked as classified material. Pollard was put under surveillance and was watched as he stuffed documents into his briefcase for removal at work. As he attempted to leave with more documents, he was stopped by FBI agents and brought back in for questioning, but he was not yet arrested. A few days later, Pollard and his wife made a break for it. They drove to the Israeli embassy in Washington, trailed by FBI cars all the way. And at the gates of the embassy, they clamored to be let in, but were turned away, and Pollard was arrested by the FBI. It emerged that Pollard had passed over 1 million documents to his Israeli handler, and in 1987, he was convicted for spying and sentenced to life in prison. Pollard had been a 29-year-old intelligence analyst when he sought out Israeli contacts and volunteered to spy for them. He had a grandiose self-concept and was given to remarkable recklessness and boasting, and was regarded by his superiors in Navy intelligence as a security risk. But somehow, in the way of large bureaucracies, he'd still been entrusted with top-secret documents. His Israeli handler was not with Mossad, but with another intelligence organization and had been posing as a graduate student in New York. Pollard's spying is estimated to have cost the United States billions of dollars because his revealing of electronic communications procedures meant that these needed to be entirely overhauled afterwards at vast expense. After his conviction, on a regular basis, there have been appeals made by Israeli politicians and supporters of Pollard to have him released, but without result. What this case makes clear is that there is often spying, even among allies, otherwise bound together in very close relationships. The Pollard case also shows how those relationships can be damaged by such espionage. It can be said overall that Mossad and Israeli intelligence and covert operations are shrouded in myths, as many people attribute or misattribute great or even superhuman capacities to them. You'll recall from our very first lecture the story, a recent story of the vulture who was caught in Saudi Arabia and accused of being an Israeli spy. To provide one other example, after a series of sporadic shark attacks in the waters off of a tourist resort in Egypt in December of 2010, the regional governor of the Sinai was quoted in the press suggesting that, quote, "a shark that killed and maimed tourists on its Red Sea port may have been intentionally released by Israeli agents to sabotage the country's tourist industry," end quote. If this shark had also been capable of passing back information, this would have been a case of fish-ent. In this lecture, we have surveyed a number of newer intelligence organizations worldwide. We saw how intelligence agencies often learn from one another, the Chinese learning from the Soviets, Mossad learning from the CIA, the Pakistan service learning from its earlier British counterparts. We've seen vigorous espionage taking place in peacetime, quite apart from times of war, even among allies. And finally, we observed that distinctive reputations or even myths are built up around different intelligence services. That theme, the myth of the spy, especially in wonderful spy fiction, we'll pursue in our next lecture.